We're going to go on now to the fourth case of the day, 082273, United States v. Brown. Good morning, Mr. Cook.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dan Cook. I'm an attorney with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellant, Marcus Brown, in this appeal. There is one issue, whether because the district court neither accepted nor rejected the plea agreement, this court should remand so that the district court may either accept or reject the plea agreement. I think I can safely say that this is a very simple issue. We're getting some feedback here. Our argument essentially is that the district court did not accept the plea agreement or reject it. We
clearly didn't reject it.
No, did not.
Accepted it or not.
Okay. Fair enough.
Assuming that we remanded and the district court rejects the plea agreement, does Mr. Brown actually want to vacate his plea and have the other counts and charges against him reinstated?
He does.
He does.
He does.
Why?
And I think if you look at the record, you'll understand why. The plea agreement, you know, this is a plea agreement where an individual who is, I think, 24 at the time with absolutely no criminal history agrees to a guidelines range that exceeds 22 years at a minimum. So it's a plea agreement where he agrees that he conspired to distribute 16 kilograms of crack cocaine, which is, I don't even want to guess what the street value of that would be. It's a plea agreement where he agrees that he's a supervisor of this drug conspiracy. And it's also a plea agreement that contains language about cooperation, and that if Mr. Brown cooperates, he's going to get 66% of the low end. And, of course, that didn't happen. So in light of those facts, I think it becomes very clear why Mr. Brown wants nothing to do with this plea agreement. As far as the legal issue, we've relied, there's really not much case law on this, especially in this circuit. I think the only case either party found was United States v. Ray, and our opinion on that case is that it's pretty much irrelevant. In that case, it's a Rule 36 case where this court decided that there was a clerical mistake and it fixed it. It's not the case here. We've cited at least four cases from other circuits, two of which in particular hold explicitly that ambiguities in this context require limited remands. One in particular, Doe, which is unpublished from the Tenth Circuit, is factually indistinguishable from this case. The issue is the same. In that case, the district court explicitly said at the sentencing hearing, there's a plea agreement with an appeal waiver. I don't know whether it's enforceable. That's up to the Court of Appeals. It's exactly what happened in this case. That plea agreement also had language, cooperation language. In that case, the defendant didn't get the benefit. It's exactly what happened in this case. So we really think that the Tenth Circuit and Doe got it right, that I think it referred to its approach as the sensible approach, and we think that's right.
Mr. Cook, if it gets remanded and Judge Duryagian says, I accept the agreement, then what? You're done, aren't you?
We are. There's an appeal waiver, and Mr. Brown, I mean, he can file a 2255 claiming ineffective assistance with respect to the waiver, but as far as a direct appeal, you're right. We are done.
He testified, though, didn't he, in other sentencings?
Who is this?
Your defendant. Oh. He testified before some other judges, didn't he? Kennelly and Judge St. Eve. And
he didn't, as far as cooperation?
Yes.
No, he did not.
He made statements about handling a lot of cocaine, didn't he?
He, his, the plea agreement contains admissions on drug quantity.
And admissions of a gun.
Yes, and the gun and the supervisor. A lot of admissions in the plea agreement.
So I guess it gets back to Judge Roper's first question about what's the end result here?
I don't know.
I mean, I agree. I got a terribly high sentence, but it seems to be the price in federal court and dealing in a lot of cocaine. It's the kind of sentences you get.
Yeah. And I just know that Mr. Brown wants to withdraw his plea.
Is the word accept a magic term? I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but does the district judge have to say, I accept the plea agreement, or can there be an implicit or effective acceptance without those words?
I think that's debatable. I think the easiest approach is, yes, it has to be a magic. I mean, why not? You know, if it's a rule that you either accept or reject the plea agreement, it becomes easier in future cases. If the court doesn't do it, then you just remand for.
But if the judge neglects to do it, is there an obligation on you to say, Judge, are you accepting or rejecting the plea agreement? It's an oversight. So, of course, I'm accepting it. Which looks like he was doing it.
Right. And that's kind of one point, I guess, with the government's brief is this would be plain error because trial counsel didn't say anything. I think Doe, in the Tenth Circuit case, trial counsel didn't say anything. The Tenth Circuit didn't seem too concerned about that. I guess our position on that is you would, if it's plain error review, you would presume prejudice. The same way this court presumed prejudice in United States v. Lupke, the allocution case. Defendant simply, I mean, how do you show prejudice? I think the difference is when you're talking about prejudice and harmless error and what a district court does, it's typically the district court does something wrong. And so we ask, well, is that harmless? Is there prejudice? But here the district court didn't do anything. So. And that's like the allocution case where the district court, you know, it failed to ask to allow the defendant to allocute. So the question becomes, well, how is a defendant supposed to show prejudice?
I think Brown get everything that the agreement promised him, except for the cooperation aspect of it, because that didn't pan out. But everything else, didn't he get that? He got the dismissal of the other counts. He got a sentence within the range of the agreed upon range.
He did. I'm in my rebuttal time, so.
Sure.
Thanks.
Hey, Mr. Hedges.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Ryan Hedges on behalf of the United States. There was no error. Excuse me. There was no error in this case, let alone a plain error that would support the requested remand to the district court. The district court accepted the plea agreement in this case. The district court repeatedly referred and adhered to the terms of the plea agreement throughout these proceedings, and the court and the parties acted at all times in accordance with the terms of the plea agreement. Defendant's argument that the district court neither accepted nor rejected the plea agreement simply does not square with reality in this case. Three supposed factual ambiguities to which the defendant points do not suggest that the district court rejected the plea agreement. In fact, those facts are further evidence that the district court actually accepted the plea agreement.
Why did you decide not to move for a downward departure under 5K1?
Well, Your Honor, that issue was addressed at the sentencing hearing, and the government's attorney made clear that the defendant had not adhere to his cooperation obligations as set forth in the obligations he had agreed to in the plea agreement, and therefore the government was not moving for a 5K.
I know, but I couldn't tell if it was because Brown provided untruthful information or if the government simply decided that the information provided in the proffers was incomplete.
I'm not sure it's that specific in the record, but it is addressed at the hearing. The government's attorney stated that the defendant had come in for six proffer sessions. And the government attorney stated that basically what the defendant had provided in those six proffer sessions was worthless. The court can read into that what had happened during those proffer sessions, but it's not in the record.
Well, I can't read into it.
Well, I think one interpretation is that he either came in and provided untruthful information, and therefore the government didn't deem him to be cooperating, or he came in and didn't provide any information.
Why did you agree with the district court after sentencing that Brown could appeal and the appellate court could determine whether the plea agreement's waiver provision was valid? Is that an acknowledgement by the government that the validity of the waiver provision is in question?
It's not, Your Honor. The government agreed to allow the defendant to preserve that issue for appeal. But what the government's position is that reservation actually is further evidence that the plea agreement was accepted here.
But you see, at the close of sentencing, the government suggested that the waiver provision may no longer be valid, the district court stated that Brown has the right to appeal. Now, does this statement have any impact on our review of the validity of the waiver provision?
It should not, Your Honor. And in fact, what the district court stated on the record was that it would be up to this court to decide whether, given the fact that the defendant did not receive 5K1.1 departure, whether there was still a significant benefit in the plea agreements, that the appellate waiver wasn't an empty promise. It'd be up to this court to decide that issue. And the fact that that issue was reserved for this court is evidence that there's a plea agreement in force here and that the district court accepted the plea agreement. And in terms of the appellate waiver, I'm kind of jumping to the end here, but appellate waivers are enforceable if they're made knowingly and voluntarily, and the defendant does not claim that his was not knowing and not voluntary, and if the appellate waiver does not amount to an empty promise.
But tell me this. Is there any reason to believe that the sentences for those other charges would not have run concurrently to his current sentence?
There's no evidence of that in the record. I think that would be – I'd be speculating if I guessed one way or the other there.
If the sentences would have run concurrently, then the possibility exists that Brown essentially received no benefit at all from the plea agreement. Is that correct?
I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. The defendant was charged in three other proceedings. Those proceedings were dismissed as to him. He did not have to face prosecution in those three other cases. Also, in the instant case, an additional count was dismissed, and the forfeiture allegation was dismissed as against this defendant. All of those were significant benefits that the defendant received.
Okay.
Unless the court has anything further, I'd simply ask the court to dismiss the appeal pursuant to the appellate waiver, or in the alternative, to affirm the conviction and sentence.
Mr. Cook.
Just on that last point, the record is very clear that the other cases were relevant conduct. In fact, that's one portion of the sentencing hearing transcript we point to show that, you know, there is ambiguity here, because the district court says, well, couldn't they, if you don't agree that this is relevant conduct, then basically they can charge you in these other cases. Well, I think that makes it very clear that you're right. I mean, there's no, the benefit at the end of the day is maybe he doesn't have other convictions. I don't even know. But at the end of the day, he's sentenced based on the drug amount of all those cases. So, yeah, there is, I mean, our position is the record is very clear that the benefit is very minimal. I mean, he received a 325-month sentence with no criminal history. So, I don't know. As far as the government's other arguments, just want to, and I know this is an unpublished opinion from the Tenth Circuit, but, quote, we find the record ambiguous as to whether the court intended to accept or reject the agreement. At the end of the sentencing hearing, the court told appellant, I think you waived your right to appeal in the plea agreement, but I'm still required to advise you that you have a right to appeal. Won't do you any good, but you can appeal. We are unable to determine why the court first stated that appellant had waived his right to appeal and then advised him that he had a right to appeal. So that's there's no difference between that case and this case. You know, the Tenth Circuit decided to remand in that case, calling it the sensible approach. We think they're right. We think it is sensible. Just ask the district court what it intended to do. And if it accepts it, great. If it rejects it, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We will go on to case number